clear communication is the responsibility of both the sender and the receiver. For example, someone say, it's not my fault if they heard it that way. I didn't mean it that way. That's their problem. Well, that's a sender bias. That's us saying my intentions are the only thing that matter here. And then the other can be true as well. Like a receiver might say something like, well, I don't care what they intended. Here's the impact that matters. Well, no, intentions do matter. It's the responsibility of both the sender and the receiver, or the organization and the employee. It is both responsibility to achieve clear communication.
Leon, I'm very excited to have you on the Core Impact podcast. And by the way, congratulations on your new book, The Congruent Leader. I would like to ask you, what is your intention behind writing the book?
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here and I appreciate the congratulations. Yes, so this book is the result of years of the work that I do with my clients, my coaching clients, with my consulting clients. Over the years and the work that I do, I've encountered so many leaders who feel very stuck or confused or discouraged about the feedback that they've gotten about their leadership. Or maybe they get up every day and they're working really hard. They're trying. They want good for their teams. They want good for their organizations. But there's a big disconnect between the intentions that they have and the impact that they're making. And so maybe they're lacking self-awareness. Maybe they're very resistant to tough feedback. Whatever the reason, they're feeling stuck and discouraged. And in my coaching experience, I struggled to find a good resource that I felt helped leaders through that part of kind of exploring themselves and understanding themselves well, seeing themselves clearly. So I decided to write it. I decided to write it myself. And, that's not to say that there aren't a lot of works out there, leadership books out there that touch on these concepts, but there was never something that I felt like was substantial enough that could you could really work through it with someone who's struggling. And so the big reason that I wrote it is because I wanted to have a resource to give to others who might also be going through something like that. So I wrote it for that reason, but also because I very strongly believe that the foundation of effective leadership is knowing yourself well so that you're able to serve the people that, you know, you're leading more effectively. Not to be obviously narcissistic or self-centered, but to know yourself well enough to know how you're going to impact the unique people around you. So that those are probably the two biggest reasons why. One was like very practical, I need a resource, and the other is more even like a conviction that I have about leadership.
Leon, I love it the way you said it, and I'm curious now to see what you work with your clients, and they hear self-awareness. From what I hear, usually I rarely hear it in business, and sometimes if someone says it, it comes like you are talking about something spiritual. It's not like it doesn't have a place in business, at least from how I perceive it, like how others see it. So what do you think about this?
Oh, I love that point that you just made. So you are absolutely correct that we do not talk about it enough in business and in leadership. And that's the whole that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. So here's what we know. Most people, you know, myself included, probably you included, we tend to think that we are more self-aware than we are. We tend to think that we know how people think about us and how they experience us and that they understand our intentions and all of that. So like some research even shows that upwards of like 80 or 90% of leaders believe that they're self-aware. But what the research actually shows, research by like Dr. Tasha Urich is a good example. She's wonderful. She wrote a book called Insight that's a great, great read about leadership and self-awareness, kind of a different angle than mine, but really great. she found that it's actually only about 10 to 15% of leaders who are actually self-aware. And the way we measure that is by looking at, you know, self-report data, how what we think about ourselves, and then compared to other report data, right? Our team members, our leaders, our direct reports, how they evaluate us. And so when there's a big gap between how we see ourselves and how others experience us or see us, that's unself-awareness. When there's a close gap, or, you know, a little gap, that means we are more self-aware. So we tend to overestimate how self-aware we are. So to your point, it has absolutely been my experience that we don't talk about self-awareness enough. And so I'll tell my clients, they may call and they'll say, hey, can you come deliver a training on conflict management, right? And I'll say, yeah. And I will tell you, main point one of said presentation is going to be about, let's reflect on who we are, our experiences with conflict, our biases, our ideas about conflict, our tendencies in conflict. Let's do that before we jump in and start talking about some very practical do's and don'ts in conflict management, right? Because if you just come in and just start giving directive to people, do this, this is good, this is bad, this is good, you're missing out on what is the foundational landscape of a human being, which is their own thoughts, emotions, you know, experiences, biases, perspectives. So I do think that we do not talk about it enough. Also, though, when you have people in your organization who are self-aware, what the research shows is you get better business outcomes, that you have much better business outcomes. Your employees are more engaged. They're more productive. Your teams are more cohesive. You get better financial performance even in organizations that have higher self-awareness among team members. So there's a business mandate, I think, for growing in self-awareness. It's just we don't talk about it because I think, to your point, it seems kind of, people will say like, oh, that's sort of like fluffy or whatever. I'm like, no, this is hard stuff. This is not fluffy stuff. This is, I need to understand how my people experience my leadership. That's not fluffy. That is like rubber meets the road, concrete stuff. So absolutely, I think you're correct. Unfortunately, you know, I think you're correct on that one. Yeah.
Leanne, what are the first things that you can help leaders to be more self-aware? And be aware of this gap especially.
Yeah. So in the book, I have a framework that I use, and I use this with my clients to help them build the skill sets and the muscles, you know, the instincts to grow in self-awareness. Because the other thing about this is it's not a one-time check a box thing. You don't achieve self-awareness and then check, now it's done and I can move on to the next thing. Like, really great leaders know that it's a mindset about pursuing self-awareness across their lifetime, right? My specialty is in their leadership, but just in general, as a human being, right? Pursuing self-awareness across your lifetime and knowing that, you know, I probably always am going to need to be a little bit skeptical, not paranoid or self-deprecating, but a little bit skeptical of how I'm perceived. Again, not to heap shame on myself, but to lead with more clarity and more authenticity, I've got to know that. So really, step one is actually a mindset thing. It is, I need to be aware of the gap that probably exists. You know, sometimes in my leadership, it might be really big. Sometimes it might be small, but it's probably always there a little bit. So I need to be mindful of that. And I need to pursue self-awareness and congruent leadership with courage and a commitment, right? And I'm gonna move towards hard feedback, even when I want to insulate myself from it. I'm gonna move towards it because I know there's freedom in the truth of how I'm experienced, you know, by others. And so that's the first part, is helping people get their mindset right. And then the second piece, I think, is, you know, there's different kind of components of this, where it is assessing what your values, what your stated values are, and then what your lived values are. You know, like, if you tell your team, I value work-life balance, and then you're emailing them at 11:30 p.m., you know, expecting a response, your stated values and your lived values are very different. And your team will perceive you as inauthentic as a result of that, you know, and will lose trust in you. And so part of it is helping leaders think, okay, what really are the values that drive my behavior and my communication? And then how do I bring those values and my actions into alignment, right? That's a lot of deep work. It takes time. I think the next part is, and in my book, the next kind of pillar here is about strengths, knowing your unique strengths. And I don't mean that just in a way that we, you know, we kind of flippantly say like, oh yeah, know your strengths. No, I mean, do you know the specific areas of talent that you bring to the table, where you bring the most value to your team, the things that you do with ease and excellence and enjoyment, the areas of your work or your relationship building that you excel at consistently? And can you figure out a way to use those strengths to help you get to the outcomes that you want? Can you lean into those strengths very strategically? The next part is becoming aware of your limitations. And I think for leaders, you know, I kind of break it down into, there's three areas of limitation, general areas of limitation. You've got things that are just talent gaps, right? So for example, I am a very structured person and I'm a very calendared person. And so like, I love to bring order and structure and predictability to chaos. So because I am so, those are my strengths, I'm very good at that, I have a talent gap when creativity or innovation or like out of the box thinking is needed. I tend to have a talent gap there, right? Now, doesn't that make sense? Because of the strength that I have, that I would have, this is a talent gap. So part of it is accepting the talent gaps that you have, not using it as a crutch, but accepting that, hey, actually, I need someone else on my team to deliver all, you know, the bulk of the creativity and the innovation. Like, there's freedom in that, but that's not my role. Doesn't mean I can't contribute something meaningful here, but I'm probably going to have to work harder and longer. And my outcome is probably not going to be as great as someone who's really talented there, right? So you got talent gaps. Then you've got weaknesses, which really is just, the Gallup organization defines that as anything that gets in the way of, you know, your success is a weakness. So I think about that in terms of, you know, my strengths when they're over applied, or, you know, when I'm using them selfishly, for example, that could be a weakness. So my love of calendars and planning and structure, a weakness that I can have is that I can be, if I'm not careful and not self-aware, I can be rigid, or I can struggle with making the method a moral thing in my mind with my team, right? Because I value this so much. So that's a weakness. And then blind spots, right? Blind spots being, you know, things that I just do not have the eyes to see. And that's where it is so important that we're moving towards feedback. I know I feel like this is a very long answer. I've got more to say about this.
Yeah,
I
can keep
going. I can keep going. Yeah. The next pillar there is about moving towards feedback. So respecting the collective perception and giving the collective, you know, people that you work with a voice to say, this is how we're experiencing you. And that's tricky. You know, you got to move towards the feedback. You got to see people the way that they are. And then you have to be thinking about the legacy that you want to leave. So that's a very long answer, but kind of walks through sort of the arc of the book that I wrote, which is, you know, self-awareness is not something that you, and congruent leadership is not something you just like check. I mean, it takes time and effort, but it is so worth it. So long answer, but there it is.
While you are listening to the Core Impact Podcast, please take a moment to pause and share with me. How do you feel? Are you enjoying the conversation, feeling inspired, or something else? I would love to know your feelings in the comments. Beautiful, Leon. I liked it. And there are three questions that came to my mind while you were talking now. One of them, maybe you can tell us a story, like about yourself. What was the hardest feedback that you've given?
So similar to actually the example that I just used is, You know, when I was a brand new leader, I was always someone who was very motivated. I was a great, like I achieved things well. I kind of was always just like that extra, like I was just very extra about everything. And so when I went to graduate school, I got through grad school. I was hired as a faculty member at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas, which is where I still live today. And very quickly, I was promoted into this high level administrative role where I had about 20 to 25 staff under me, like overnight. Wow. And I was very young relative to my colleagues. You know, I was very young and I was terrified. I was, I felt very overwhelmed. And suddenly I was realizing, okay, so now my success is not just measured by my output. It's now I have to rely on these 25, you know, to 30 other people to, you know, reflect hopefully that I'm doing a good job. And that this is where shame and pride and fear can come in as a leader, is when you're like, oh, now I have to trust people. I have to enable these people to help me get to good outcomes. So I was so young, I was really out of my, you know, scope, out of my depth in a lot of ways. And I struggled tremendously because I was really wanting to replicate myself into all of these people that I was leading. I was trying to sort of figure out, okay, how can I get them to be more like me? You know, and I know that sounds very narcissistic and selfish. And it was, I didn't realize that, but it was, I that was all I knew, was how to lead like me. And how to, you know, have all of the skills and the strengths that I had. And so I fought for several years, not realizing that what I was doing was, because I'm so structured and, you know, because I'm so organized, that I was trying to impose that strength onto everybody else that I worked with. I was trying to sort of fit, make everybody else fit into that. And I was not allowing for the unique development of other people in that. And so to your question about feedback, I actually got some feedback from some of my very best staff members at the time that they could see how stressed I was and how burned out I was. And part of why I was so burned out was because I wasn't getting those outcomes that I wanted with my team. And I remember sitting down and one of my really great staff members said, your problem is that you're not paying attention to anything except what you want, you know, the outcomes that you want. And I remember thinking, you know, whoa, well, that was very brave of you to say, you know, but it was true. They were right. And it wasn't until I started thinking a little bit more critically about the unique strengths and talents of the people that I led, that I was able to get out of that very burnout stress place myself. But it was very painful feedback, you know, for me personally, because it spoke to a real deep issue that I have with kind of letting go of control, because I value structure and predictability so much. So I'd say that. And then the other thing I will say is I did, however, get very good, sadly, over time responding to negative feedback because I was a professor. I taught one of the largest courses on campus, public speaking. So I had like 1,500 students every semester. And so I got a ton of student feedback over the years. And so I always will tell people, you want to get tough, you know, about feedback, you just let like an anonymous 18 to 22 year old college student tell you what they think about you and your class and all that. And you'll be, you know, you'll get a lot of really tough feedback. So I have gotten better at that over the years, but I'll never forget that one time sitting in my office where my TA said that to me, because it was hard, but it was true. Hmm. Yeah.
And would you like to share a feedback as a leader that was tough for you to give to others?
Yeah, I get to do that a lot. I consider that a very weighty privilege to give feedback to people, because here's something we know about feedback. two things are true. Most people say and believe that they want more feedback, right? Like, for example, when I help organizations facilitate employee engagement surveys, I hear this all the time from employees. They're like, we need more feedback, right? And then when I tell leaders that, hey, your people want more feedback, they're like, well, when we give them feedback, they're mad at us, you know? And that's the other truth is, while we say we want feedback and we do believe we want feedback and we know we need it, we also tend not to respond very well to tough feedback, right? Because of shame and fear and, you know, pride and all of those things. So I consider it a very weighty responsibility to give tough feedback to people. I have had a lot of practice at that because as a teacher, again, I, you know, have evaluated just thousands and thousands and thousands of student work over the years, their speeches, their papers, you know, their work. So I got, I think, pretty decent at that. And then with my team, you know, it is learning how to deliver feedback to people in a way that they will actually hear and feel seen, heard, and known, but also challenged to grow. And then now in the work that I do, you know, I mentioned I do a lot of coaching work, and there's a lot of times where I do have to give very tough feedback to my coaching clients. Let's say I help them facilitate a 360 review. And so I have to tell them, guess what? You know, the results are saying that maybe your team doesn't feel like they can come to you with problems, or they don't feel like they trust your leadership. That's a tough message to have to deliver. Or sometimes when I go to, you know, organizations and I have to sit across from a CEO and say, you know, your team members do not enjoy working here. You know, those are tough messages to have to deliver. And what I have found is that, one, I think people do respect the truth. They respect when you tell them the truth, but you have to, when you're delivering feedback, you have to deliver it in a way that is future focused and helps people see this as a part, not as something that defines them, but as a data point, as a perception point along the way to help them grow and learn and develop and close that gap. And if you can do that, you know, respect them enough to tell them the truth, but also give them their dignity and help them feel seen and understood in it, you tend to get better outcomes. So, yeah, it is a weighty responsibility. I don't take it lightly, that's for sure.
Leanne, there's something also I'm thinking about. You said that yesterday I was attending the workshop. You said that it's important when you talk to others not to tell them or assume how they feel. I think either you assume how they feel, how they think, or who they are. You tell them you are good or bad at XYZ, coming also staying in the feedback topic. How can you always think about giving factual points? Let's say this happened based on this survey and this company, this and this. And then we go to the CEO, I say, there is a survey, there is a study. There is something happened, like, you know, without giving lots of opinion, and then, you know, focus on more facts and then give the advice in a way that everyone could accept. Like, what is the method you use usually to give the feedback?
Yeah. Well, I love the point that you're making. It is very important that when you're delivering feedback of any kind, whether it's critical evaluative feedback or actually positive feedback or recognition, is the more concrete and specific you are, the better. So when I train leaders and managers how to give feedback, one thing I say is, look, if you just say, good job, I mean, that's a great message, but it actually doesn't tell us very much, you know, that the best messages, the best feedback is concrete and specific and individualized. So it's not just great job. It is, hey, the way that you synthesize, you know, ideas so quickly in that brainstorming meeting, you know, was exactly what we needed to be able to make the decision that we made so quickly. Thank you for your strategic thinking skills that you bring to our organization. You hear the difference there, right? It's the same thing with critical and evaluative feedback. If I just say to someone, you need to work on your communication skills, well, what in the world does that mean? That could mean a million different things to a million different people. And it also it feels so ambiguous that that's just going to shut someone down, you know? But if I say to maybe one of my team members, here's a pattern that I'm noticing, you know, in our team meeting this morning, I observed you interrupting 5 different team members and jumping in and talking over them. When you use that kind of communication pattern, here's the impact that it has, or here's what it can cost us as a team. So, you know, moving forward, what I'd like you to work on is X, Y, and Z, right? Now, again, that's still painful to hear, but it's concrete enough that someone, if they do want to grow, and that's important, if they do want to grow, that they've got handles on what the real problem is. You know, hey, you were rude in the meeting today is not helpful, right? You were rude because you interrupted is not helpful. Here's what it costs us as a team when we don't let people finish their thoughts, right? That's a better way to deliver feedback. So I think that's the biggest takeaway when I'm thinking about feedback, is it's got to be concrete, individualized. It's got to be as specific as we can possibly make it, whether it's critical feedback or positive feedback.
Leanne, I noticed that from everything that you do, that you focus a lot on research, and you like to have like data based when you talk about anything. So there's a study that I wanted to see how do you see it, which is 26% of employees, that was also from you, I remember yesterday, strongly agreed that the feedback they receive helps them do better work. So only 26%. Is there anything also more you like to talk about this study?
Right. Isn't that so if you're a leader, that's just can feel so discouraging that only 26%, you know, of employees think that we're giving them great feedback. There's so much research out there about the importance of developing continuous feedback rhythms in our organization. When I talk to employees, some of the things that they say that, you know, are reasons why they don't enjoy, like they don't feel positive about the feedback they get, is one thing that they'll say is the feedback is not happening in the flow of my work. It's not timely. So I submit a report to my leader. I think everything's fine. A week and a half later, I sit down in a one-on-one with, you know, him or her, and they're like, we need to talk about this report. You know, here's all the ways that you messed this up. And the employee is thinking, what? I've been operating under the assumption for the past week and a half that everything was fine. And now I feel not only discouraged about my work output, but also a little bit like trust is damaged, because why didn't you tell me this? Right. So one of the things we hear is, you know, that feedback is not timely, that it's not happening in the flow of work. Another thing we hear employees say a lot is that feedback feels kind of, to my point just a moment ago, that it feels too general and too nonspecific. It's abstract. I don't know what it means. I hear this a lot from leader or from employees when they'll say like, oh, I got feedback that I need to work on my executive presence, or I need to work on my strategic thinking skills. Well, again, what does that mean? Where is there a gap? What specifically do I need to work on? So I think it's twofold. You know, as I just said, it's part of it is a systems problem, that we're not building continuous feedback rhythms in our organization, which, by the way, helps us grow in self-awareness on a regular basis when we're getting good feedback to know where we stand. But then also the other part of it is, you know, training and equipping managers to know how to deliver the kind of feedback that closes the gap. Yeah.
Leanne, there's another study. We're talking now about new hires, that only around 12% of employees strongly agree that their organization does a great job on onboarding. What do you think about this study?
Oh my goodness. Yes. So talk about organizational self-awareness, that I can't tell you the number of times that I've had, you know, clients will bring me in to help them facilitate some employee listening initiatives, and I'll dig and I'll find something, you know, in the organization and share that data. And the leaders are like, what? We just worked on that, or we just revamped our onboarding program or our job descriptions or whatever. And I'm going, well, you're not getting the outcome that you intended. So you got to go back to the drawing board, right? So with onboarding in particular, I think it's a really good example, and I'm glad you brought it up. It's a great example of, you know, every organization I know has phenomenal intentions. They like nobody's waking up and saying, how do we create an onboarding environment that stresses everybody out and makes them regret their decision to work here? Like, nobody's doing that, you know, nobody thinks that. But then we're not doing the work to strategically listen to, in this case, new hires, to understand, you know, where do we build in communication touch points or connection points or information, you know, close the knowledge gap? Where do we do that across the onboarding lifecycle so that at the end, our employees say, you know, wow, that was a transformative onboarding experience, right? So we assume, and then we don't move towards the feedback. And so that's the problem. It's we have organizational lack of self-awareness because we're not moving towards the feedback. Just like as a leader, we can have low self-awareness because we're not moving towards the feedback. Mm-hmm. 100%. Yeah.
This is a general question, but I'm curious to see how would you answer it. How do communication and change management intersect with employee engagement?
Yes. Communication, whether it's in change or not, which change management is really just about communication. You know, that's really what it is. So I'll just answer that kind of broadly with communication. Communication is what drives employee engagement. So when you look at what we know about employee engagement, there are a lot of different drivers of engagement. And you look at things like role clarity and expectation. Do employees feel like they understand their role and how their role contributes to the overall vision and mission and values? Well, guess what? For an employee to know that, there has to be strategic communication happening on a regular basis about that. Think about the employee engagement driver of recognition or feeling valued in the workplace. That's always one of the lowest. When I do surveys, the employees don't feel valued. Guess what? How do you improve that particular driver? You got to communicate that on a consistent basis, right? You look at things like drivers that relate to feedback. You know, have I gotten feedback about how I'm performing? Well, obviously that's communication. What about drivers of, like, someone around here cares about me. My leader cares about me and sees me as a person. Well, how else does one accomplish that without communicating? So to answer the question, it is, communication drives engagement, or it will kill engagement, you know, like the messages that we send. So the one thing I always encourage leaders to do and organizations to do is, you know, focus on what is the outcome that we want? Okay, if we want employees to feel like they are cared about as unique people, then where across the life cycle, the employee life cycle, are we going to be sending messages about that? You know, just like we worry about our customer journey, we spend a lot of time, organizations will spend a ton of money on focus groups and doing all kinds of customer listening and surveys and trying to understand and getting in rooms and talking about the arc, you know, of the customer experience. And then we don't do that for employees and wonder why we're not getting good outcomes with our employees or why our turnover is off the chart. So if we would just take some of those same ideas and apply it to our employees, we'd be much better off. How do we put communication touch points across the life cycle to drive engagement? I think is one of the most strategic questions that leaders and organizations can ask.
Leanne, I'm going to take now the devil's advocate hat. And I listened to someone saying, even if there are studies that show that when managers appreciate their employees and they say thank you more, etc., they feel more valued, as you were saying, feeling valued, and they perform more. But there's something missing, because this is something that's short term. And if the employees themselves, they don't have the self-worth and, you know, the self-confidence, then nobody from the outside can help them. So what do you think about this?
It's a great point, because I do think it's something I I talk about in the book a little bit is sometimes, you know, when we talk about self-awareness and just mindfulness about ourselves, it's easy to talk just about the person who maybe is not a very good leader and they think they're a good leader. But what about the person who is actually a phenomenal leader, but doesn't see themselves that way? And so they go home at night and there's still a gap. They still are lacking self-awareness because they're not accepting the collective perception that they're doing a phenomenal job, right? They have self-awareness work to do too. They have to close the gap as well. And that is sometimes the hardest work that has to be done, is accepting that we do bring talent or value, or that we're making, you know, meaningful contributions when we don't feel like we are. So there's so much to be said about that point that you just made. But here's what I will say. I think with the praise and recognition piece, what I have found is we as humans respond very well to feedback that is, again, so concrete and specific and individualized that it's very hard to ignore. If I'm your boss and I'm just saying, you know, hey, great job, or thank you for your work, or you're doing a 5-star job here, right? If I'm just doing those kind of things, it's easy for you to go, they're probably just saying that to be nice. She probably says that to everybody, you know, and downplay the contributions you're making. But if I approach you and I say, I need you to know that I was able to listen to you facilitate that really hard conversation with a client yesterday, and the way you handled that with poise and, you know, assertiveness and kindness, the way you handled that is exactly the kind of communication that reflects our company values. Thank you for that, right? So now what I'm doing is I'm telling you something that is so concrete and specific that even if you struggle with the way you see yourself, you kind of go, huh, well, that's a data point that's hard for me to ignore, that I actually, I did a good job in this instance, right? So I think, I do think that the more concrete and specific and individualized your messages, the more you build confidence in people around their areas of talent and strength. So that's not a cure-all, of course, for someone who maybe struggles with their own self-worth and the way they see themselves, but I think it's a step in the right direction. Yeah.
Leanne, also talking about the future of work, what excites you the most regarding connection, more self-awareness, employee engagement? What are the trends that excite you and see you may be optimistic about?
Yeah. So I'm very, very excited about, as everyone is sort of, I think, dipping their toe into the world of, you know, AI and automation. And I will tell you where I'm most excited is I do a lot of work with leaders who struggle with their communication. And so, like, historically, I was a communication professor. I still do teach one communication class for an MBA program, but I used to be full-time faculty. So I was teaching communication courses, you know, forever. And the hardest part is getting people to think about communication, not just as like the words that come out of your mouth, but actually about the strategic decisions that you make, about messages you send. And there's so much strategic thinking that goes into good communication that I work with a lot of leaders who struggle with that part, right? And I see AI and some of, you know, even like virtual reality as being these tools that I think can help us in the areas that where we struggle with, like, decision intelligence, making decisions about messages. And so practically what I mean by that is, and I shared a story about this yesterday on a webinar that I did about AI, but I had a coaching client who was struggling to prepare for a really tough performance management conversation that he was going to have. And he admittedly was like, I'm not great at this stuff. I'm not great at thinking strategically about the messages. So we took he's very methodical note taker though. Like he's very like had a ton of notes about all from his one-on-one conversations with this team member over the past several months. So I just suggested to him, let's copy and paste some of your notes into, you know, your AI agent and let's see what it says, like what recommendations it has for how you approach this conversation. And we had been talking about it. I had been kind of coaching him, but he had all this data and I thought it would take me a week to look through all that data, you know, just as a human. So let's run it through ChatGPT. So we did live on our call. And immediately, you know, it's prompting, it's giving us different ideas. It's saying, oh, here's an angle. Here's a way you could frame this message. Here's some data from some of these one-on-one meetings. And then me and this, my client were able to look through it and he's kind of saying, this one doesn't really work and I wouldn't frame it this way, but this is brilliant. And I would have never thought about this on my own. So once we had that, like, thinking piece ready to go, then he and I were kind of, to use a colloquial expression, we were like off to the races. We were ready to go to start crafting some specific messaging. And so I think what excites me about the future of work in my area is if we can use those tools to help us deliver more impactful messages to people, not cookie cutter canned messages, but like real messages. If we can use them to help us with our communication decision making, oh, imagine how much more meaning we can create with one another on a human level. So the tool can help us do what humans can only do, which is exchange meaning with one another. So that gets me really excited. I've heard you know, some people talk a little bit about some things that are on the horizon as far as virtual reality for people to practice tough conversations or to practice, you know, leading a really tough team meeting. And that also gets me excited. So I think there's a lot of cool stuff ahead as long as we keep the human to human connection central and the outcomes that we focus on central. I think there's some cool stuff ahead.
I like also, I remember yesterday in this webinar, you were saying it's very important to see how the message is delivered when a company or the leaders talk about AI and what the changes that needs to happen, instead of saying kind of, we have to change because of AI, there are so many things that needs to be done, instead of that will help. How was the message? Like that will help us all be kind of in harmony. It was the message delivered in a way that it's about, in a constructive way, that it is about you also. It will help you reduce your kind of boring job and then you can be more creative, something like this, right?
Yeah. Well, it is, you know, we just take for granted how powerful our messages are. And the messages that we send are like a flight plan. They send us in a particular direction, you know? So when you are sending messages to employees about whether it's AI adoption or it's anything, right? Change management in general. If you're sending messages and the outcomes that you're focusing on are not resonating with your audience, you're on a flight to nowhere, essentially, right? But if you frame your messages in a way that speak to outcomes that matter to the specific people and the specific audiences, you get buy-in and you're on a good flight plan. So with this particular example, it's the difference between saying to employees, hey, you better get with the program and start learning AI because we want to use AI to make more money and, you know, build a bigger, you know, audience, or we want to improve efficiency and we need to get more out of you. We need to figure out how to get more out of you, right? Well, we wonder why employees are feeling anxious about AI when you're sending messages like that, that those outcomes don't resonate. But if you are sending messages to employees about, you know, hey, let's explore and experiment with this new tool together. Yes, it's a little scary. We know it. Yes, it feels a little creepy. It's like a little exciting. You know, we're all like really interested in it. Let's explore it together and let's see what's possible in your role. Because wouldn't it be so cool if this tool could help you facilitate tough performance management conversations easily, right? What if this tool could help you streamline your workflow and could help reduce the, you know, administrative load? What if it could help you create more time to do the strategic things that only you can do? So you hear the difference between those messages, right? I mean, if you hear this message over here, that feels like I'm a cog in a machine. You just want me to increase my output and you're demanding that I learn this new tool that I don't really want to learn. And over here, I'm thinking, whoa, well, maybe this is actually going to elevate me. Maybe this helps me grow. Maybe this helps me reach my goals and we can accomplish some cool stuff together. So it very much is realizing that the messages that we send create meaning that sets us on paths. So it's a weighty responsibility when we communicate with people. We got to think about it. So I love that point that you brought up. It's a big one, and I think we just take it for granted.
I think people feel so much, and sometimes leaders underestimate that. Like the person who really wants people to grow with him in the company, let's say, is different from someone who just wants people to work for him and he doesn't really care about them. And there is one, let's say, core reflection from the conversation now is, it doesn't matter which position you have and who are you communicating with, a human being with a human being. When you have a clear intention or expectation from what you want from the other person, what the other person wants from you, and you just talk in a, let's say, relaxed way without any kind of, you know, fear, or you want to put a message in a way that has any kind of, or leads to any kind of conflict, then you can reach anything you want actually with people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you definitely are much more capable of having real solid meaning exchanged when both people are thinking about that, right? And it does take, another thing I say a lot is, you know, clear communication is the responsibility of both the sender and the receiver. So sometimes we tend to bias towards whatever we are at that given moment. So for example, have you ever heard someone say something like, well, it's not my fault if they heard it that way. I didn't mean it that way. They heard it that way. That's their problem. Well, that's a sender bias. That's us saying my intentions are the only thing that matter here, right? And then the other can be true as well. Like a receiver might say something like, well, I don't care what they intended, you know, here's the impact that matters. Well, no, intentions do matter. And so it is both it's the responsibility of both the sender and the receiver, or the organization and the employee. It is both responsibility to achieve clear communication. So where there is ambiguity, I always teach people, if you're on the receiving end of a message that creates ambiguity or fear or whatever, as much as you can, you need to move towards the message, the sender again, to try to close the gap if there's miscommunication too. That's your responsibility as well. And I think when both parties do that, we're in a much better place to get to a good outcome communicatively.
Leanne, we talk also on the podcast usually about inclusion, and I like to talk diversity, inclusion from different perspectives, because usually, let's say most people see it from one, two angles, but it's really much broader. And one thing that I would like to talk about that I saw that also something you are interested in is the generational diversity. So how do you tailor engagement strategies for, let's talk about, for example, three generations, Gen Z, millennials, and Gen X.
Yeah. Ooh, you brought in Gen X. Most of the time, people forget Gen X. Most of the time, if people are going to talk about three, they're going to say baby boomers, millennials, and Gen Z. So kudos to you for not forgetting the Gen Xers. So, you know, my position on generational diversity well, one, I believe that generational diversity is such a gift to an organization. I mean, I think we, just as any type of diversity is a gift, I think we take for granted and we don't talk about generational diversity as much. But I feel like when organizations do this well, there is such wisdom and a dynamic spirit to the organization when you really do value the full human lifespan and the contributions that you can make across the lifespan, you know, in your work. So I love that. So I value it very much. I do think there are some general, like what research shows is there's some general, you know, again, generalities about each generation, things that we know really matter to them. But the interesting thing is when we look at like engagement data, it's pretty constant from Gen Z all the way up, and I'll include baby boomers, like that we all really do want the same things. You know, we all really do. Now there's little pieces here or there that are a little different, but in general, we all pretty much want the same things. An example, like a myth that I think a lot of people have about generations is they'll say like, oh, baby boomers or like Gen Xers, like they don't really want recognition in the workplace the way that like Gen Z or millennials do. I'm like, cite your source. It's not true. It's just not true. Now, the way that we receive recognition might be a little bit different, but I can't tell you the number of times that I've sat across from a baby boomer or a Gen Xer who has said to me, I don't feel like my work is valued at all here. You know, I don't feel like I'm seen at all in my organization, right? So we all have, you know, most of us have the same needs. However, there are a couple of interesting little things that we do see. For example, millennials are very, very, like for them, it is very important that they have a mission and that like that their organization, connects to mission and values that matter to them. That's very important to millennials. Millennials historically have also really cared a lot about relationships in the workplace that have mattered to them. So friendship, especially for females, like for women in the workplace, relationships and having a close friend seems to be a very big driver. Gen Z, jury's still out because they're still, you know, entering the workforce. But the research that we see is they are they're very independent and autonomous, but they're also very entrepreneurial, and they come in with like a real problem solving mindset. And so there are some differences that we see across generations. But what I find, you know, is the case for organizations who do the best job is that they listen well. They listen. They move towards the feedback. I'll give you an example. So one of my clients is a medical practice, and they had several locations, but still kind of a small to medium size business, right? And so I went in and was helping them with an employee engagement survey, and then I did some focus groups for them. And one of the things that we found was we asked them about benefits, how they felt about all the benefits. Well, if the millennials who had like teenagers, you know, at home, were saying, oh man, we love like the extra medical like perk benefits that we get. So this was a orthodontics office, by the way. And so they were saying like, we love these like orthodontics benefits that we get. Like that just means so much to us that our bosses and the owners would give us these benefits. Well, because they had kids who needed braces, right? But one thing that we heard from the younger, like Gen Z employees, is they said, well, like those benefits don't mean anything to us. That doesn't affect me at all in my life. And I don't have kids. And the owners were, you know, they kind of said, oh, like we didn't even think about that. Like we hadn't even thought about the fact that our younger employees, those benefits don't communicate value the way that they do for our millennial or our Gen Xers. And so they were able to offer some additional benefits that spoke to some very unique needs of their Gen Z employees. And they wouldn't have done that if they hadn't done the employee listening to get that feedback, right? So I think if you're going to excel at generational diversity, just like any kind of diversity, you got to move towards the feedback and then, of course, act on what you've learned. Yeah.
What is the number one blind spot you see from leaders when you talk about employee engagement?
Number one blind spot. That's a great question. That's a hard one to answer because it is every organization is and every leader is so unique. I think the biggest blind spot probably is that leaders and organizations think that what employees want are these big grand gestures, like rolling out the red carpet. They want big things. They want, to big initiatives or big events or things like that. And actually, what employees really want is they want the slow drip. They want the consistent. They want to feel those things every day in their work. They want purpose in their work every day. They want connection in their work. They want to find meaning and to feel valued in their work every day. So I think sometimes organizations will invest in a lot. They'll spend a lot of money, on some big initiative, and meanwhile, employees are saying, "That's not really what we want." Like, thanks for that, but that's not really what we want. I have a story that sometimes I'll tell about an organization that they had decided they were going to do this really big offsite event for their team, and they spent so much money and so much time and so much resources, which is a reflection of their intentions. They wanted to do good. They wanted to communicate to their employees how much they valued them. And so they spent so much. They gave employees like some spending money to kind of go on like a little shopping spree kind of a thing. And they did all of this to communicate value to them. So fast forward just a few months later, when they got their employee engagement survey data back, the number one weakness from what their employees said was, "I don't feel valued in my job." And the leaders were really upset because they were thinking, "What? We just did this whole thing to show employees how much we value them." And I was facilitating a focus group with this team, and this woman in the group, she said, I'll never forget it. She said, she said, "We appreciated that. We really did. It told us something." But she said, "But like if you're in a relationship with someone and you feel like they love you and they trust you and you're in a good, healthy relationship with them, every day you feel seen and known. If they do this big thing for you, it feels like icing on the cake. It's like the cherry on top. It feels like a beautiful gesture that has happened in the context of this already great relationship. But if you don't feel very seen or respected or valued on a regular basis and they spend a lot of money on you, it actually kind of hurts and it kind of feels like they're trying to buy you back." Or she said, "It actually makes me kind of resent them a little bit." And I think that is a blind spot that a lot of leaders have, that they think that it's the big stuff that employees want, when in reality, most of the time, it really is just the day-to-day stuff, which is why the day-to-day communication is so important.
You remind me of what you said previously, at least what I understood, that it's more important for companies to have stay interviews than exit interviews.
100%. Now, I do love a good exit interview. I think you can still get some really good data from an exit interview, but exit interviews don't help you with what is sort of like your systemic retention challenges. Stay interviews, conversations that you have with employees while they're still employed, to learn what's working, where would you like to see us grow? What would compel you to look elsewhere? What would help you stay here for the long term and grow your career here? Those kind of conversations, you tend to surface so much better insight, that can actually help you, whether you're, a executive or an HR leader or whatever, build systems that lead to employees staying. So I'm yes, stay interviews, huge fan. I love facilitating them. I love equipping organizations to facilitate them. You can still do your exit interviews, but I go all in on some qualitative employee listening, like stay interviews or focus groups. You'll learn so much more.
Do you do them systematically, like for example, once a year for every employee or how?
Yeah, great question. It depends. It depends on what your goals are and what your outcomes are. Stay interviews work very well for kind of targeted roles. So stay interviews take a lot of time. They do. They take a lot of time. So I don't recommend necessarily just doing them with every single employee. But let's say, for example, that you are an organization and you're noticing like some turnover in this particular area. You might say, let's find maybe 3 to 5 of our team members who are either really high potential talent, like we want them to stay, we see a lot of potential in them, or those that maybe have stayed for several years, maybe they've been here a while. Let's have some targeted strategic conversations with those 3 to 5 and see if we can spot any patterns or identify any themes. And that might help us close the gap on some of these other, you know, with some of these other employees. Or maybe you decide, you know, we want to do stay interviews with all of our middle level managers. And we want to see, are there any themes that are emerging here for who decides to stay versus who decides to go? So stay interviews are really great depending on what the specific objective is. Like, what is it that you want to learn? You know, another tool that I use a lot is the focus group. Focus groups are great in surfacing kind of collective sentiment. And you get a little bit of a different effect when you've got a focus group rather than a stay interview. Yeah. Big fan of both. Different methods to get to different outcomes.
While you are listening to the Core Impact podcast, please take a moment to pause and share with me. How do you feel? Are you enjoying the conversation? Feeling inspired? Or something else? I would love to know your feelings in the comments. Another question about the future, Leanne. What are the 3 top future skills that every change maker should have in the next decade?
3 skills every change maker should have. Okay. Well, I think I would be remiss if I didn't say, right, strategic communication is number one. And I think the way you get to that can vary. You can use tools like we just talked about earlier to help you with your strategic communication. But I think anybody who wants to lead change, wants to enable change, has to be focused on the messages that you're sending and how you're sending them and why you're sending them. So I think strategic communication is one, and there's a lot of ways to get there. Perspective taking is another, which is, the ability to understand the motivations, priorities, the constraints, limitations of unique stakeholders. I think people who manage, in my experience, people who manage change the best are people who have an ability to understand multiple perspectives from multiple people. So perspective taking is the second one, I would say. And, this is a broad one, but I would say some measure of agility or adaptability, the conviction to be able to reroute, is another part of that. I find the leaders that I work with who are the best at managing change are people who they're narrating the change along the way, which is using those 2 skills we just talked about, but they're also very composed in their agility and their ability to kind of move and bend and reroute, re-goal, to kind of rolling priorities. You know, I think that's the 3rd skill, I would say. Yeah, that's a little bit broad, but that's what's coming to my mind.
Leanne, I'm really enjoying the conversation with you, and I'm really feel like this is the flow state. You know, I'm focusing with you. I'm forgetting everything else in life. So you are helping me also with being present with you. There are so many questions I wanted to ask you, and I think we're not gonna make it. Let's say if someone is listening to us, and they feel disconnected, unheard, or maybe close to burnout, what is the one message that you'd like to leave for them?
Oh, man. So I think even before any kind of tactical thing that I would say, what I would really want someone to know if they were listening and they were feeling that way is, my word, you are not alone in that. That in the work that I do, I was doing this work pre-pandemic, obviously, which it's been a minute since kind of the height of the pandemic, but we were sort of on a path to, I think, collective burnout and collective, searching for meaning and trying to figure out, like, who are we and what are we doing and does this matter and all these big questions, right, about life. I think we were sort of on a path to that based on my work kind of pre-pandemic. I was seeing that. And then we sort of were like, we just crashed into a brick wall and sort of had to kind of start confronting a lot of this stuff, you know, when, again, the height of the pandemic. Since then, what the data shows is that we are more burned out. We're more stressed. We are struggling for meaning and purpose more than we have. At least that's what the data is showing, right? I mean, the Gallup organization right now has just coined a term not too long ago called the Great Detachment, which is this idea that right now we're at a record low where only about 30%, I think it's 30 or 31, I can't remember the specific, I think it's 31, 31% of employees, only 31% agree that that their job helps them find meaning, like they find meaning in it, right? And, you know, I think that's caused by a lot of things, obviously, the world that we live in and there's so much we could talk about there. But what I would say to someone that is struggling with that is, one, you are definitely not alone, but two, you do still have so much agency to find meaning and purpose in the work that you do, even independent of the recognition or the valuing messages that may not come from others, you know? So when I'm working with someone one-on-one who is in that place, I like to go back to the basics with them and affirm them in where they are, but then let's find some meaning and some purpose in what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. So what are the parts of your job that bring you the most energy? You know, the parts of your day where you feel a little bit more alive in what you're doing, that you feel like what you're doing is connected to something bigger than yourself. And for my clients, even just having a conversation like that can sometimes spark momentum and purpose and meaning. So I think if you're feeling that way, you know, one, you're not alone, but two, you've got agency to find meaning and purpose independent of the messages that others give you. So start small. Find something very small in the work that you do that brings you energy, you know, and try to ride that. You know, use it as an on-ramp to something bigger. But yeah, I have a big heart for people struggling with burnout. I work with a lot of healthcare professionals. And oh my goodness, the data on, you know, burnout in healthcare is just off the charts right now. And so it's a topic I think a lot about right now. Yeah.
What gives you
energy? The most energy?
Energy gains.
Yeah. So there is nothing that I love more than getting to help someone else, whoever it is, discover what is very unique about them. Like I have always been someone who is very fascinated by the uniqueness of people. And actually in the book, I tell a story at the very beginning about when I was a kid, my mom nicknamed me the nose. Because I was very nosy about like people, and I was always like asking, I was always right up in it. Like I wanted to know everything that was going on with other people all the time, not necessarily in like a gossipy way, but I just was so curious about people. And so my mom nicknamed me the nose. And so I've always been that way. I've always been very curious about people. So the work that I get to do with individuals and helping them understand themselves more, helping them see themselves clearly, like that fills me with more energy than I know what to do with sometimes. I love it so much. In fact, I can struggle with getting to burnout because I love what I'm doing so much that I will say yes to every bit of it. You know, I will say I love it so much. I will say yes to every little bit of it. It'll bring me so much energy. And the next thing you know, I'm like, I have no time on my calendar because I love every single conversation that I'm about to have today, you know? So I have to almost be careful about that on the other side because I do get to do the work that brings me so much energy all the time. And I am very aware on a regular basis that I do not ever want to take that for granted because I get to do work every day that makes me feel very alive, you know?
Eliane, I don't remember. I asked this question or like similar questions to so many people recently. I don't remember when was the last time that someone answered my job, what I do. This is what gives me like the energy gains the most.
I love it.
So there is a question. Oh, before we end, there's a general question I would like to ask you. Is there anything else that you think it's important but we haven't talked about, talking about employee engagement, the congruent leader, or AI?
Oh man, we've talked about a lot of fun stuff today. You know, I think if I had to sort of say one thing that we haven't touched on quite as much, it is that I think sometimes in leadership, we have this tendency to, we have a tendency to make leadership feel like it's this very like lofty, ambiguous thing that, oh, it's, you got to be this super motivational, inspirational leader. You've got to, you know, you've got to do everything. The expectations are so high. And one of the pieces that I very much care about in the work that I do is I want people to know that if you care about helping people get to good outcomes, you can be a great leader. You know, if you're analytical, maybe you're not the most emotionally intelligent, or maybe you're not the most like winsome communicator. Maybe you're like a really scholarly, analytical person. You can also be a really good leader. The trick is, how do I use the talents and the strengths that I have to get me to better outcomes? Whether it's change management, employee engagement, right? Increasing productivity, whatever it is. Like, how do I use what I have been given, the strengths and the skills that I've been given to get there? Because I do think that sometimes in our leadership development curriculum, we make it like leaders are this very high up, like very ambiguous thing, when really it's about getting to good outcomes, using the skills we've got and serving the people around us. So that's the only thing I think is a message I kind of shout from the rooftops a lot with people that we haven't talked about is, regardless of the skill set you have, you can be a great leader as long as you care about helping people get to good outcomes, you know? I do think that that's important to say. But otherwise, we've talked about a lot of stuff. Yeah.
Leanne, you reminded me of this. I recently read this, that you cannot tell me that you are a leader if you don't show me another leader that you coached or mentored, right?
That's right. Yeah.
There's a question from my previous guest, Megumi Miki. She's the author of Quietly Powerful. And she asked the question, what do you think it will take for organizations to really start valuing diversity of style and thought in leadership? So she asked me to ask to a relevant future guest, and now I'm asking you this question.
Ooh, I love it. Okay. Well, I think awareness. I think it's awareness. And so when this is work I do too. So if I go into organizations, one of my offerings that I have in my business is I'll go in and assess employees using a talent assessment. It's a statistically reliable and valid instrument from the Gallup organization called Clifton Strengths. I use that quite a bit in my business. And it is going to give organizations visibility on the diversity of talent that they have, thinking, right, same way of thinking. It sounds like that question is kind of getting at the same thing. So here's what's so powerful about that is once you give people a tool to kind of open their eyes to talent diversity or diversity of any kind, right? Thinking diversity, what communication diversity. Once you give people a tool, then you can start facilitating conversation around it. And so suddenly when people's eyes are opened, now we can start communicating about it and we can say, oh my goodness. Yeah. So you are phenomenal at brainstorming and you have a million ideas a minute and what an incredible talent. And I am really good at executing said ideas. And so, wow, what if we partner together and, you know, your ability to generate ideas and my ability to kind of put legs to it and to make it go, like imagine what we could accomplish together if we did that. Right. So I think it's the awareness and the communication that then facilitates progress in that area. And so that's one of my very favorite things I get to do is to facilitate those conversations where people suddenly go, oh, I didn't quite realize that you had this very unique talent that we've maybe not been taking advantage of as a team. And can you dial that up a little bit for us? Because we need it. And you know, you can benefit from the skills I bring. So I think it's awareness and communication.
Thank you very much, Leanne. Do you have a question that you'd like me to ask a future guest about that you've been reflecting on, you're curious to know more, like a different perspective about?
Ooh, okay. A question that I would like for you to ask a future guest. Oh, man. I think we talked about it already, my biggest go-to question to kind of help somebody start a path to like better self-awareness and congruence is the question that we talked about a minute ago, which is what are the parts of your role that bring you the most energy and make you feel the most alive? And then the other side of that is what are the parts of your role that drain you of energy or that feel suffocating to you? And those are some of the questions that I ask in my very first coaching sessions or in workshops. And they are, again, on ramps to some of the most meaningful conversations that I've ever had. So I think that would be my go-to question. Based on just the work that I get to do and the kind of conversations that matter to me.
Thank you, Leanne. I really enjoyed the conversation. As I said, it was real. I was in flow. We talked about so many topics around employee engagement, your book, The Congruent Leader, about AI, about the future of work, about lots of statistics and numbers and lots of also stories from your work. So now I only have no question, but the room, the space for you to have any final thoughts.
Oh my, well, thank you so much. This was a really fun conversation. I had a wonderful time and just appreciate your thoughtfulness and your conscientiousness. And let's do it again in the future. I'd love to.
Yeah, man, for sure. Okay, then thank you very much. I wish you a joyful day and we stay in touch, Leanne.
Thank you so much for having me.